to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby,
beautiful.
British
thank you so much. People. It's over. Sorry about that.
Hello and welcome to CanQueer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith, and without us today is Sebastian. But it is not so. Fear not, regular listeners of the LGBTQ talk show CanQueer. We will be seeing him back to us next week. We have a lot of ground to cover. Even though we have this lined up, earlier this week, I had the absolute pleasure of having an interview with Dr. Christopher Wells, who is a Research Canada chair on child and youth, particularly. And we started talking about, we had a conversation about really what has been a major hot topic for the last little while in terms of gender pronouns and so on in the high schools. So we will also be joined, hopefully any moment now, by we're doing an interview with the incredible festival over in Montreal, the Massimadi Festival. Naomi Cameron, who is the project manager for Momentum, the mentorship initiative that they have, will hopefully be joining us very soon. I have one eye on the Zoom, hoping that they will jump in. If not, we'll jump to him song. Give them a call on the old-fashioned phone and see if we can get them in that way. But whilst we wait for them to connect, we have a couple of updates. Now, folks will possibly cast their mind back and remember that one of the linchpins behind the United States equal marriage court cases was the decision by Kim Davis, who is a Kentucky county clerk. She refused point blank to marry David Emerald and David Moore. And then that created a whole, domino effect of court cases, one right after the other, all the way up to the Supreme Court, with the Supreme Court eventually deciding in favor of it. Even despite the Supreme Court decision, Kim Davis insisted that despite being elected to office where she has to abide by the laws of that office, she insisted still on not certifying the marriage of David Emerald and David Moore. She has just lost the final appeal of the appeal of the appeal, they have been awarded $50,000 in damages after that. This has been going on since 2015. So it's been, what are we looking at, 7 years now, 8 years since she made that refusal to participate. So it's all going on. In other interesting news, we've been talking about a few times in the show, we've been talking about how the culture has been shifting and the sort of anti-wokeism backlash that has emerged and so on and so forth. And there's an interesting outcome that we want to share with folks. We mentioned a little while back about how Chick-fil-A, which for a long time was very much panned and decried as its most senior leadership, I think the president of the board or the CEO, regularly donated to causes that actively lobbied and advocated against LGBTQ rights in various states around the United States, as well as anti-abortion initiatives. The restaurant famously isn't open on Sundays in the United States. But despite this deep-rooted homophobic history in terms of funding anti-gay initiatives, they still expanded and they have, I believe, thriving businesses in Canada, including in downtown Toronto. But they also had several businesses in the United Kingdom. until people really started to figure out that maybe this isn't a business that is worth, you know, supporting. They have the unfortunate challenge in the UK of going up against well-established rivals such as Nando's, which has a bit of a fledgling presence here in Canada, as well as a number of other chicken joints from across the world. I think there's an UAE chicken place as well that has actually just recently opened in Canada as well. But anyway, there a lot of people like, you know, if I want to buy chicken, I can buy chicken in lots of places, and these other places aren't as actively homophobic as Chick-fil-A, so I'd much rather just get my chicken from over there instead. And that, with boycotts and protests, Chick-fil-A shut shop and essentially evacuated the country of Great Britain, closing all of its stores and leaving with its tail between its legs. Now, however, sensing a bit of a shift in the political winds, Britain has been under a Conservative government for, I think it's like 10, 12, maybe 13 years now. They've gone through more prime ministers than any country reasonably should. And they have now decided that they're going to go back to Britain and relaunch a whole bunch of stores. Hopefully, I think they're banking on Brits having short-term memories, and hopefully thinking that they won't recall the fact that they were boycotted. But it's interesting because they're planning to spend $100 million to crack that particular market. So it's definitely a whole range of things happening. I am not seeing Naomi joining us on the call. So whilst I line up our first track, which is Marigold, the clean version by Begonia, we will be jumping to that in just a few seconds. But whilst I line that up, I also wanted to share some pretty interesting news out of Andorra. The Andorran Prime Minister, Xavier Espo Zamora, has come out as gay in a national radio interview just last week. But most importantly, he kind of pointed out, despite being gay, he's never hidden it, just never really advertised it either. He is now apparently the 8th head of state to be openly gay worldwide. That's sort of where we're at. But yeah, his point to the Andorran national press was, you know, it's not been an issue for me. I've not flaunted it, but I haven't hid it. But most importantly, if to young Andorran children in the country, this now makes politics something that is potentially possible. And we talk a lot on the show about being seen and seeing yourself represented in places to be able to see what's possible. Anyway, we are jumping now to Marigold, the clean version by Begonia, and we will be back just after this, hopefully with our interview with the festival out of Montreal. Hello and welcome back to Kangwe, home of Canada's queer media. My name is still Luke Smith. We have reached out to the festival, Masimadi. Now, we are quite excited about this. We will, you know, go ahead and recommend folks reach out to it. Anyway, the Masimadi Foundation, they do a couple of different things, and they've combined them both this year for the 15th anniversary, which is very, very exciting. They are really focused on promoting out LGBTQ2I plus African folks to really celebrate the arts and culture of Black LGBTQ communities and providing a platform for the dissemination that advances the artistic creation of Black and queer communities. The reason why we're talking about this festival that really is centered in Montreal, we're not actually currently broadcasting in Montreal, but I'm sure there are people in Montreal listening. But for folks who are not in Montreal and are thinking, why are you talking about this festival in Montreal? I'm nowhere near it. But they are really focused on promoting really emerging artists, filmmakers, screenwriters, and they do a number of workshops as part of this initiative, conferences, mentorship, and all kinds of other support to take some of these emerging creators to help them create a thing which is then released at this festival. What's of note here is that it's being released online and can be viewed by anyone nationwide. So we're pretty excited about that. We were notified about the 15th anniversary edition. It is Canada's only Afro-queer film and arts festival, according to their press statements. And their program is available nationwide. So yeah, as I mentioned before, on September the 7th, they were celebrating their 15th anniversary. It's going now from the 11th through to the 30th. Lots of opportunity to go and check out what's available and what's on offer. And we will hopefully get Naomi on the call to see more details. But yeah, we are excited about it. Hopefully, as I said, we can make this connection work and go from there. But once we do, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Brandy Lancaster Library. Now, this is in Kansas. We do occasionally mention it. And I think this is a good, we seem to mention this a lot, examples of where extreme reactions have really blown over. You know, I believe that our audience is very measured. You are reasonable people. But the folks in charge over at this Kansas library may not have been as measured and may not have been as reasonable. Two librarians have now sued the Sterling Free Public Library in Sterling, Kansas, after they claimed that they were fired in June for displaying what was allegedly a rainbow symbol and a Pride Month display. The Kansas Librarians Board was so outraged at the idea of promoting LGBTQ material that they immediately fired two librarians. However, it was the rainbow infinity symbol, which is a logo that is very often used by neurodivergent and autism rights advocates. So the display and the selection and the symbology was around promoting books and contents written by and written for, written about folks who are neurodivergent and autistic, to kind of raise awareness and understanding in their community in Kansas. But it seems like awareness and understanding was in pretty short supply in Sterling, Kansas, as their board fired the librarians outright, believing wrongly under some bit of a homophobic misjudgment that it was an attempt at a pride display and not as it was actually a display around promoting understanding for neurodivergent folks. It even said, you know, we all think differently, and it was just a selection of books and a small window display. And I think this gives us a good idea of really taking a moment here to just allow calmer heads to prevail as it goes on. All right, What I'm going to do now is we are going to jump to our interview that we did earlier in the week with Dr. Wells. This interview discusses a number of things, in particular legislation that was proposed in New Brunswick, Alberta, and I think even Ontario is toying with the idea around parental rights and the rights of the child. This man is one of the leading experts in the country on young youth, especially LGBT youth. We were very, very lucky to be able to have him join us. We will continue to try and connect with Naomi. But until then, this is the interview with Dr. Wells, and we will be back after this. Hello, and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. This is the interview that I was excitedly referring to a little earlier before we dived into our other interview with the festival. I am very excited to have on the line the incredibly talented Dr. Christopher Wells. Now, your resume is really speaks for itself, but for our audience, I think what's really worth noting here is that not only are you a professor at the University of McEwen, you're the Canada Research Chair, Tier 2, for the public understanding of sexual and gender minority youth. You're also the editor-in-chief of the International Journal of LGBT Youth. I don't think we could have found an expert with more expertise in the subject matter that we're going to be diving into today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for that generous introduction. My mom will be very happy to hear it when I play this back. But I think first and foremost, what, you know, how I describe myself to people is I'm a teacher. I came as a classroom teacher. I came to the university working alongside LGBTQ youth in our community. And that's what drove me to do further studies, was to figure out how to make schools safer and more inclusive for them. And so, you know, that's always been my focus, is not really in doing the research as much as mobilizing the research out into the communities to help make the change that we need to see.
I think we are at a moment in time, and just before you spoke, just before we started recording, you talked about that idea of what is old is now new again. And I want to kind of set the scene for our listeners. You know, we have been, the LGBT folks have been decried as different, as other. I recently watched a documentary on Netflix about the El Dorado in Berlin, really talking about the late 1800s, early 1920s being the center of research into sexuality and gender identity, and trans folks were walking around, you know, bold as brass, because that's what was possible in the 1920s, you know, 100 years later. And we seem to be digging up this old manure of an argument around, you know, the idea of danger and risk and what have you. So as you see various provinces and various politicians, more often than not, conservative politicians, advocating for what has been coined parental rights, this discussion around being able to publicly identify yourself as trans under the age of 18, or even accessing healthcare, is now up for debate, is suddenly outrageous. It's the cause du jour. It is the big topic of the day. Does this surprise you in any way?
It doesn't surprise me. It disappoints me greatly, and it angers me. And I think many, many individuals that, here we go again, we're having to fight these battles all over again. It's as though, right, that queer children don't exist, right? And that it's a threat for them to exist and to be visible, and that somehow we magically just appear as adults, right? But for many of us, we know we had to go through that period of struggle and depression, where we felt we had to remain hidden to be able to survive. And the impacts that that had on our own mental health and well-being. And what, you know, gives me such great hope is to see, you know, queer young people be themselves at earlier and earlier ages, and to find communities of support and affirmation and families that love and not only accept them, but celebrate them for who they are, right? This is just a tremendous change, I think, in our community. And we're seeing that now being under attack. And it, as an educator, it doesn't surprise me that this is happening and targeting schools, because I really believe that schools, number one, are at the heart of our communities. And, and it's where we're raising our next generation of leaders, of, you know, citizens in this country. And so, you know, to have this queerness be, you know, visible, you know, in our school system is a threat to the very future of our society by some people. So they want to take over schools. They're not just concerned with pronouns and chosen names, but they want to censor books. They want to write to us LGBTQ people out of curriculum, you know, out of our textbooks. And I often say, what does it mean as a queer young person if you don't see yourself in the halls and the walls and the textbooks in your classroom, right? It sends this message that you don't exist, or you don't have a right to exist. And, you know, this is also, we've seen, you know, in Ontario and other places, in Alberta, for sure, battles over gay straight alliances, right, in schools. And we won those battles. And here we go again. Now they're targeting the most vulnerable with, trans and non-binary young people and their right to name themselves, to self-identification. And, you know, as though, you know, this was a problem, and it's not a problem. Schools have been doing this for a long time, mm-hmm. and without incident, that it's being this manufactured political controversy for, very concerning reasons, like, you know, a real distraction, really a political tactic from the real issues that matter to most Canadians, the economy, right? Food inflation, housing. And so it's no surprise to me that this is a conservative governments that are leading this attack on our 2S LGBTQ communities under the guise of right parental rights, as though right parents own their children and should have complete unrestricted say over, you know, their very lives and well-being.
I want to dive into that in just a moment. But before we do, you know, this is, you know, I referenced as far back as the, you know, 1920s. And then we think about, Thatcher in the 80s and Section 52, which attempted to ban gay people from being inside schools. It seems like every generation, God forbid the gays, and now in this case, young trans folks, seems to have bubbled up. When you were speaking, you reminded me of an interview I did about 10 years ago with, I want to say, Margaret Macmillan, but I think she wrote a history book and she's not the lady I'm thinking of. But I interviewed the leading doctor at the gender clinic in Ottawa 10 years ago. And we were talking about what was, I thought, fantastic news. Just to bear with us for a second here, listeners, we know, and a bit of a trigger warning here, we know that suicide ideation among trans folks is a magnitude of double figures higher than non-trans folks. Trans folks who are not provided with appropriate care and support, frankly, struggle to survive. And that is played out in hundreds and thousands of deaths. Like, it is a sad, grim Canadian reality that trans folks don't always survive. And then in steps earlier recognition, in steps loving relationships and families and medical care. And we know from trans folks that being able to transition sooner, so you're not reversing any kind of biological development, you know, that they transition more easily, that there's more cultural acceptance, and that suicide ideation drops off a bloody cliff because there is, you know, all of these support. We were in a place where young trans folks, their lives are being effectively saved by us moving forward as a Canadian people. But now the debate at the recent Conservative convention is about access to healthcare until you're over 18. That undermines all that, you know, and I think it speaks, and you touched on it briefly, this idea of children as chattel or as the property of their parents. You know, I've been sort of somewhat familiar with the Children's Aid Society, not myself directly personally, but there are plenty of parents that don't have a stellar record and may not have the rights of the child first and foremost. So as we have the Minister of Education in Ontario saying, I consulted with experts, i.e. some parents of some children, how concerned are you by that?
Well, absolutely. The first question is which experts, right? Because all the experts that we know actually fully support, whether you're talking about health, education, gender affirmation, right? And the exactly to what you said, gender affirmation, gender affirmative care is suicide prevention, right? And it's proven to show. And you know, the message I have with parents too is simple. It's right. You need to love your children for who they are, or you will lose them, right? They will run away, or they will have an estranged relationship with you for the rest of their lives, or they'll take their own life. And the choice of that relationship, the quality of that relationship, is largely up to you as the parent, right? You're the adult here, you know, in this relationship. And we know, this notion of if you're not safe at home, right, then, you know, you go to school. And if your school is not a safe and accepting environment for you, well, too often, right, then what's left for you? It's the streets, right? And it's becoming houseless or street involved. And that amplifies all of your risk factors exponentially. We know it's a lot harder to get a young person off the street than to prevent them from being on the street in the first place. And so, you know, this notion that now somehow governments wants to legislate outing, you know, trans and non-binary kids by asking their parents for permission to affirm, you know, their gender identity or their name. And it's a bit of this whole debate is a bit of a misnomer, because all parents ever have to do if they want to know this information is simply ask your child, right? It's not the job of the school to tell you or the medical professional to tell you these things, right? If your child feels safe and comfortable having this discussion with you, they will, right? And nobody's hiding information from parents, right? In fact, many ways what we're doing is working with these young people to facilitate that conversation with their parents. And young people I've had to work with, one of the, you know, realities is we have to talk about a safety plan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what happens if it doesn't go well with your parent, right? And you feel that threat in your home environment, or they, you know, kick you out. And that's the other reality. You know, research shows that, you know, upwards of 40% of all homeless youth in Canada identify as 2SLGBTQ+ or somewhere on that sexual and gender diversity spectrum. So we have a huge overrepresentation, and it's because of the major social institutions in their lives, family, school, government, have failed to support and protect them. So, you know, we know there are these risk factors, but working with these young people to develop, right, the tools to have these conversations, to put a safety plan, you know, in place. And we're really, our goal in particular in schools is to always put the best interests of the child first, right? Not the best interests of the parent first. And so, right, that necessitates, you know, almost a one-on-one individualistic approach, right? Because no one sort of comes out the same way, no one transitions the same sort of way. But ultimately, these young people need to know that there's somebody in their lives who supports them, right? Even if it's not their family, or they're scared of their family's reaction, maybe it's a coach, right, on a sports team they play with, or maybe it's their, we would hope, right, a church leader or a teacher or somebody in their lives that the research tells us young people need at least one supportive adult in their life, and we hope that they would have many. But unfortunately, that's still not always the case.
You know, I get the sense that this parental rights argument is a red herring, and it is painful to discuss, because when you talk to Joe Schmo on the street and you say, should parents be told about, you know, a quite significant life change? You know, one's own gender identity is a pretty big thing. You know, nobody is going to look at that and go, no, do not tell the parents. That's outrageous. Don't tell them. You know, no one's, it's an impossible position to argue from. However, you know, we're looking at reams of data, disproportionate number of homeless youth are LGBT, disproportionate, you know, rates of suicide ideation. You know, it just, all the data seems to suggest that there are some truly horrific outcomes that could happen. Abusive family homes, you know, not every home is a